Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Carl Jung, one of the founding fathers of psychoanalysis, carved his own way. Freud went for repressed emotions and desires. Jung went for visions, for the delights and dangers of the unconscious as a doorway to the universal, to the soul. Now Jung's controversial personal diary, sealed from public view for more than 100 years, is out of its Swiss vault. It's being published. It's a dizzying trove of hallucinations, intricate paintings, and the dialogue of fantastical gods and devils, a rich quarry of visions from which he mined his life's work and the foundation of his theories. This hour On Point, we're opening up Carl Jung's secret red book. Joining me now from Portland, Maine, is Sarah Corbett. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Her article about Carl Jung's red book, The Holy Grail of the Unconscious, appears in the September 20th issue of the magazine. Sarah Corbett, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I have this book in front of me, and it is really quite astounding. First of all, it is huge. I mean, it puts a great big atlas to shame. It is fully red-covered, as his original folio was. It's a combination of old kind of German-looking calligraphy and the most astonishing illustrations. What was Carl Jung up to here, Sarah?
Well, I'm afraid there's no short answer for that, Tom, but I will begin by agreeing with you. The book itself is a magnificent object. It is enormous. It is ornate. It is difficult. It looks like it landed, you know, if not from the Middle Ages, then from another planet entirely.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's going to be a while before anybody can really explicate what's inside. And I have a feeling that there are a lot of Jungians and historians and psychologists who are getting ready to do so.
Surreal scenes of, I don't know, bizarre, like other planetary sunrises. It looks sort of like NASA's visions of deep space and tree trunks and flying serpents and crocodiles and, I mean, you name it. There's kind of a St. George and the dragon thing, deeply sort of psychic, I don't know, drawings from where we know not, except Carl Jung's imagination.
Right. This is a true representation of Carl Jung's inner world. Which is why I think it's really fascinating to a lot of people, because he holds nothing back in this book. It is psychedelic. It is wild. It bears no resemblance to his outside world. One of the misconceptions about the book was that it was a dream journal, because it was kept out of sight for so long. Mm-hmm. The way it was conceived of was, because he didn't hide the book per se. He wrote about it actually in his memoir, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which many people who've studied psychology know about.
But he did not put it out there for the public, and it was in a Swiss vault for,
25 years it's been in a bank vault, right. Mm-hmm. What happened was Carl Jung, when he was about 36 years old, started having visions and dreams that worried him, that he didn't understand. One of his early visions was of a flood overtaking the Alps in Europe. He was Swiss, and mm-hmm. he was on a train, and he had a vision of water flooding the Alps, and then the water turned to blood. This was 1912, and he would later decide that maybe it was a precognitive dream foreshadowing World War I. Mm-hmm. And it ties into the way Jung sees the psyche, that he believed that we have a collective unconscious, a pool of wisdom that all of humanity shares, and that perhaps the psychic disturbances that were then leading to World War I, although nobody knew World War I was coming, was starting to impact the collective unconscious. But for about 6 years, he had a stream of visions. And he decided, he was a psychiatrist at this point and a very successful one. And rather than kind of trying to push them away or to let his rational mind win out, he gave into it. He actually participated in those visions. He encouraged them. He would sit at night in his home in the Zurich suburb of Kuznak and try to interact with these people that were springing from his unconscious and talking to him. And so that's what you see in the red book. And it's disturbing, and it's unusual, and it's very rich and, you know, to some people I think very deep, that he tried this. He worried that he was going crazy. But he also felt that by looking at that madness, by trying to interact with it, he was going to find a source of creativity, and also that he was going to develop a method, which then became analytical psychology, the Jungian method, which really involves interacting with one's unconscious and finding the riches there and integrating them into your conscious life.
He would eventually say that everything else is to be derived from this, and by this he meant this gigantic red book, red folio sitting in front of me right here. How does this sort of wild tales, narrative, and fantasy, and vision quest here, how did it show up in what Jungian analysis became, Sarah?
Well, a central part of Jungian analysis is dream interpretation. I think if you haven't studied Jung, if you haven't been involved in the Jungian world, you know, probably the one thing people associate with Carl Jung is dream interpretation. What you see in the Red Book goes beyond dream interpretation, but it's the same concept. It's these he called his visions active imaginations, and this is also a part of the Jungian method. Somebody who's in Jungian analysis may be encouraged by their analysts to actively engage in their dreams, to bring, if you have a meaningful dream, to bring it back during a quiet moment and then really try to examine the contents. And as we all know, dreams are freaky things, and they're unusual landscapes, and often they bear only the most passing resemblance to our earthly existence. And, you know, that's the connection. The other part is that Carl Jung developed later in his life, really what this is, the Red Book, is a document of for lack of a better term, a midlife crisis. He had spent the first part of his life building a very successful career. He had a young family. He was wealthy at this point. But he really started to question the meaning in his life. Mm-hmm. And this, he called this period the confrontation with the unconscious. And for him, all of his theories, the second half of his life, the theories that he is most well known for, really sprung from these years when he was examining his own self, when he was trying to find his own inner cosmology, if you will. So concepts like the anima and the animus, the idea that our souls are represented to us by the opposite gender. So a man will have a female soul, a woman will have a male soul, and the quest to integrate those things. The idea that people have a shadow side to them, personality types, a lot of the collective unconscious, a lot of the ideas that he became famous for and that have slowly seeped into mainstream or more mainstream psychology came from this really intense period.
A period where he was exploring everything and said that this was the basis for everything. He wrote, "All my works, all my creative activity has come from those initial fantasies and dreams." But he said repeatedly that he thought the modern humans had been robbed of that inner life, that they needed to turn and find their soul and work through that to self-understanding or individuation. But you and others write that in this period, when he turned to do that, he found he didn't know his soul. This was his effort to find it, to envision it?
Right, and his soul quite literally is a character in the Red Book. She comes and goes throughout the book, but she's there, and she's a presence, and he dialogues with his soul, as well as he dialogues with gods, he dialogues with the devil. It's wacky stuff, and Jung himself recognized this. He put an epilogue on the book. He worked on it really from about 1914 to through the 1920s, and then he just put it away. He literally put it in a drawer in his home, and he showed it to a few people. He debated whether to publish it, but he knew that this was risky stuff, and he was trying to establish himself as a scientist in a rational world, and this would have done him some damage. But he also recognized the value, and he penned an epilogue in 1959. He died in 1961, so he was nearing the end of his life, and he penned an epilogue, and he said, you know, to the superficial observer, this might appear like madness. And I think that the very fact he wrote an epilogue and was thinking about his observers meant that he did want this to come out at some point. He never left any instructions about when, but arguably, now is a good time. We might be perhaps more ready for the ideas he's presenting.
Now, for a mere couple $100, anybody can have this book. His family was very touchy, though, about having this come out.
They were. You know, this was one of the interesting things of this experience for me. I spent about 2 years getting to know the people involved with this journey that the book took from a bank vault to a bookstore near you. And the Jung family, Jung had five children. He has 19 grandchildren, not all of whom are living, but most of whom are. And they inherited, you know, they inherited a burden, as any family does when somebody dies and leaves behind a creative or intellectual legacy. They had to figure out how to administer it. And it's not an easy task. And the Jung family was very generous in spending a lot of time talking to me about what their process was. And I think in essence, as the generation of Jung's children who knew him personally and felt very protective of him, you know, slowly passed on, and the grandchildren started to take charge, and now they're a handful of great-grandchildren, the personal connection ebbed just a little bit. They're right on the edge. They're still very protective. I think they're nervous about this whole thing, but they also, they start to see the scholarly value, the cultural value of handing over their grandfather's works to a larger public. Take a ride to the land inside and you'll see how happy life would be if all of mankind would take the time to journey to the center of the mind. Would take the time to journey to the center of the mind.
With us as well now, a Jungian analyst, David Oswald. He's been a licensed Jungian analyst for 17 years, graduated from the C.G. Jung Institute of Zurich in Zurich, Switzerland. He joins me in the studio. He's got Carl Jung's red book in front of him, and he's had just, I don't know, a part of an hour to look at it. David Oswald, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's nice to be here.
What's your response to this? Is this the Holy Grail?
It is simply an astonishing book. I was emailed the text of this book this weekend and read the text, and I was just completely astonished at the text. And now I come in today and I see the pictures, and I am astonished again. I don't think that the Holy Grail is quite the right term for it, but as a picture of Jung's encounter with the unconscious, it is just a remarkable document.
So help us begin to understand, as a Jungian analyst, he thought that if we, you'll correct me please if I'm wrong, but if we dive into our own unconscious and try and pull up images, we are in fact diving into a collective unconscious, to something shared. So if these are his images, are they yours and mine as well somehow?
It's not that there are images, it's that we have the potential to experience similar sorts of things. It was Jung's attempt to say, can we find a source of enlightenment that is inside of us? This red book starts out very interestingly saying, don't come to me for teaching. I'm not trying to teach you. This is the way and the the way and the truth and the life is inside you. It's not coming from outside. And this is only the story of one man. I'm going to try to be as honest as I can about what's inside of me. And this is the result of what he came up with.
I've got a little bit of tape here of Carl Jung. This is 1959, an interview on BBC's Face to Face, where he, Carl Jung, talks about his understanding of the human psyche.
You know, there are these peculiar faculties of the psyche, that it isn't entirely confined to space and time. You can have dreams or visions of the future. You can see round corners and such things. Only ignorance deny these facts. It's quite evident that they do exist and have existed always.
Carl Jung in a BBC interview from 1959. Sarah Corbett, New York Times contributing writer, is with us, and David Oswald, Jungian analyst. The Red Book, David Oswald, have you known about it as long as you've been involved in studying Jung? Everyone's known it was out there, but here it is.
Everyone knows that it has existed, and Jung himself had said that it was the source of his works, and everyone has been enormously curious as to what they would find.
Sarah, I wish you'd begin to take us a little more through what's actually in this book. I mean, it's got a kind of a, I'm trying to think of what might be more popularly known. It almost looks like some of the works by Tolkien, the elaborate calligraphy, the drawings, kind of illuminations. But tell us something about the text, and we'll turn to David as well. But the text and images, is there a narrative here, Sarah? Is it bits and pieces and flashes?
It's a little bit of a narrative, and it's a little bit of bits and pieces and flashes. To me, it's very Dante-esque. He's in this book, Jung is a pilgrim. I think one of the surprising things is he doesn't use any psychological terms at all. He speaks of his soul. It's a spiritual journey he's on. And the other thing about it is it's very dark. It's where he goes in his own unconscious. He's really looking at the darkest parts of himself. He has a lot of conversations with the devil. He really wrestles with God and particularly the Christian conception of God. He develops. I'm curious to know what mm-hmm. David thinks because I'm not a Jungian, but you know he does develop. But one thing that really struck me and surprised me as I was reading the book is that he's very humble. And people who've read Jung biographies or those who knew him personally, humble is not a word that often is applied to Carl Jung. He was a really charismatic, dynamic man mm-hmm. who was full of confidence. But I was struck by, on this journey, he was really torn down. You know, he was somebody who was really, truly experiencing a crisis. His crisis looks a lot different than probably most of our crises, but he, you know, the way he navigates it, I think there's real value in it.
David, I want your response. Let me read just a little bit so our listeners can have a sense of the kind of text. I mean, there's everything, cesspools from the underworld and winged serpents and boiling blood. He says, here's just a bit, descent into hell in the future. This is one portion. He says, I see a gray rock face along which I sink into great depths. I stand in black dirt up to my ankles in a dark cave. Shadows sweep over me. I'm seized by fear, but I know I must go in. I crawl through a narrow crack in the rock and reach an inner cave whose bottom is covered with black water. But beyond this, I catch a glimpse of a luminous red stone which I must reach. I wade through the muddy water. The cave is full of the frightful noise of shrieking voices. And on goes Carl Jung in his Red Book. As you read here, what do you see, David Oswald?
This is a typical nature of a fantasy that when one is working with the unconscious, that a person goes in and puts themselves into the fantasy activity of the mind, and one carries out and interacts with it as if it were real. And one of the interesting things about this Red Book that makes it more than just a kind of a story of a journey is that Jung, although he was saying, I'm setting aside my scientific attitude and really trying to look at what's there, he kept up as a scientist and saying, I am going to treat each of these things as a very much a reality, and I'll write down what happens, and then I'll step back and I'll look at it and say, what does this have to do with me? And so this book is really, it's a collection of chapters that represent different episodes, experiments, he called them, where he would sit down and create this fantasy, like the one you just read, mm-hmm. and see what happened to him. And then he'd sit down and he would say, now, what about this place that I was in? What does that have to do with me? Or why would my soul be a desert?
But this was not entirely a controlled experiment. As Sarah points out, he wondered himself if he had verged into madness here.
That's absolutely true. It's not, well, it's controlled. He has control over his ego, over his I. And what the development of that Carl Jung offered was saying, let's take the unconscious on its own terms. The unconscious is not just an object. It also is a subject in some way that it can speak for itself. And can we learn to listen to it? And when we listen to it, what comes out of it? So these were his experiments to really listen to
their
conscience.
But there were elements of crisis in this exploration.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that typical, or is that the founding master's sort of a hero journey to bring this to us?
The unconscious, in terms of crisis, when a person's conscious attitude or conscious mm-hmm. world is under stress, when that falls apart or when that's threatened, the unconscious is behind it. The unconscious is always there, and it will tend to come up more. People will have wilder dreams at times of conscious. People will have unstable emotional mm-hmm. interactions with their people. So the unconscious is always there. When consciousness breaks down, then one is really confronted with this reality that's there all the time, but usually we keep it at bay with our conscious adaptation.
And now the Red Book of Carl Jung right here on the table in front of us, and it is astonishing. Let's begin to bring our listeners in. Elizabeth in Charlotte, Tennessee. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, what do you know of Carl Jung, Elizabeth?
Yes, I do. For a time I lived in Minnesota, and I happened to have read just quite by synchronicity, by chance. I read a biography of Carl Jung that fell into my hand practically, and then since then I have my life has just been I've just completely been in love with Carl Jung and the whole thinking. And the another book that I had read was a book by Clarissa Pinkola Estes called The Women Who Run with Wolves. And my reason for calling is, I could go on forever about how my heart is pounding. I'm so excited about getting this book in my hands. I have a lot of his volumes, and I've gone, when I lived in Minnesota, I used to go and listen to Robert Bly talk in the different basements of the churches.
Robert Bly, who took men drumming in the woods. What has Jung done for you, Elizabeth?
For me, it has made me, just everything. If you take the individuation, then you read Joseph Campbell, Robert Bly, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, and you become a real person. You're a real person, regardless of whatever anybody else out there is proponing. When I was traveling through Europe with a friend of mine, I went to Lake Zurich, and I took the boat and I went around the lake. I knew
this is Jung's home, famously his home, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 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 and. Throughout my whole entire life, it's like a thread that has woven through my life.
Elizabeth, we're very happy for your sharing that, and thank you for calling. Sarah Corbett, I mean, in many ways, Elizabeth talks about Robert Bly and Joseph Campbell, who many got to know through the Bill Moyers series and his own work, of course. But, I mean, in more ways than we might think, though Jungian analysis is a minority within the community of analysis, I think, but it has imbued our way, it's come to imbue our way of looking at a lot of the world, Sarah.
I think so. And that passion that Elizabeth was just expressing, I've heard that from a lot of people. And it's really wonderful. People respond to Carl Jung in incredibly deep ways. He also has his critics. He's a controversial man. And
describe the controversy for us, if you would.
Well, a lot of it goes back, interestingly enough, to his split with Freud. Carl Jung actually was a protege of Sigmund Freud's back in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. and at some point they began to part ways, and it was very painful. They were very close personally, they were very close professionally, and it was a painful split. They analytical psychology, Carl Jung's way of seeing the world, was different from psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud's method and way of seeing the world. And that split, it's really something that surprised me how profound and enduring that split is. If you talk to Jungians, they might start saying, well, the Freudians think this, or you speak mm-hmm. to a Freudian, there are big quote marks around this because it's mm-hmm. it's impossible to generalize.
But Freud had hoped that Carl Jung would help take his psychoanalysis out to the greater world. And in the end, they just had different perspectives on the psyche.
Carl Jung started developing, he drew a lot from Sigmund Freud. And also, it was an incredibly rich time in psychology. And there were a number of other psychiatrists doing really interesting work from which both Freud and Jung were drawing. But yes, like any good student, he was starting to think his own way. And that, for Freud didn't like that. He was sort of notoriously autocratic. And so it was quite a painful split. If you read the letters that the two men exchanged, they start, they're almost like love letters in the early years. Yeah. And then the last few letters, they are so bitter and so sad. Mm. I did want to mention one thing that Elizabeth talked about was the process of individuation, which David could talk about more, of course. But you know, the Red Book is really Jung's individuation. It's his way of finding his own maturity. And I think that's why the publication of his book is striking a lot of chords, not just among Jungians, but among people who've been influenced by Jung. And that's what she was talking about, this sort of wider culture. One thing I found really wonderful is that the Red Book, Carl Jung's Red Book, is now the number 3 bestseller on Amazon. It's a $100 book. It's $105 on Amazon, and it's right up there with Ted Kennedy's memoir and the new Dan Brown novel.
Right. And bookshelves will be able to accommodate it. This is takes a big coffee table.
Right, but to me, I think it indicates that people really cherish their inner lives and that they're curious. You know, I think nobody knows quite what to make of the book and what its contents will teach them. But the idea that Carl Jung worked really slavishly on the art in the book and he made it a beautiful object is really appealing to people, because I think that's something that gets lost very easily in contemporary life.
David Oswald, as you look through the pages of this book, I mean, this does not look anything like what I think of as Freudian. I mean, this seems to be evidence that these two guys had to have a parting of ways.
They had to have a parting of ways.
This is myth and fantasy and inner vision.
Absolutely. And when you talk about the conflict, there was, of course, a personal dimension to the conflict. There was a theoretical dimension to the conflict, and in subsequent generations, there was always a certain amount of enemies of my friends or my enemies too. But I think I look at Freud and Jung as being representatives of two different ways of approaching the unconscious. And it is simply the inner world. One reason why Jung and Freud have such a deep impression on people is that they were so deeply into their own reality. And a person's inner world is the most intimate possession that they have. It is the most ultimate reality that they can experience. And they are the only person that has a direct line to their own reality. And Freud and Jung were people who both pursued that in very different ways, but with an intensity that most people today don't do. And I think it's that dedication to the entirety of their inner life that makes these people such fascinating influential people on people today.
Well, it is an astounding document on the table right in front of us here. A couple hundred pages of the most amazing graphic representations of a world beyond conscious sense, drawn by Carl Jung, and his German calligraphy throughout. David Oswald, Jungian analyst, is with us this hour, and Sarah Corbett wrote the big piece, The Holy Grail of the Unconscious, for the New York Times Magazine. Here's Peter Gabriel, a no small acolyte of Carl Jung. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. David, Sarah, let me read just a little more to give people a sense of this. Here he writes in the Red Book, "My soul," it's almost kind of like a psychedelic psalms from the Old Testament of the Bible. He says, "My soul," but those are a little psychedelic themselves. Here, reading from the Red Book, "My soul, where are you? Have I entrusted myself to a stupid animal? Do I stagger like a drunkard to the grave? Do I stammer stupidities like a lunatic? Is this your way, my soul? The blood boils in me, and I would strangle you if I could seize you. You weave the thickest darkness, and I am like a madman caught in your net. But I yearn, teach me." My soul spoke to me, saying, "My path is light." And there's Carl Jung from the Red Book. Let's go to Ginger in Charlottesville, Virginia. You're on the air, Ginger.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
My main concern, I'm a clinician in our adult outpatient services here in Charlottesville, and I've been a fan of Mr. Jung for many years, having read Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, which I understand from Ms. Corbett's article was the result that he decided to present to us from the work, which is described in the Red Book. Mm. And the thing that I have some concern about is the statement that was made earlier that these kinds of things that he experienced are within each of us. And I think we wouldn't want to be misleading someone to think that the kinds of things that Mr. Jung in particular experienced would necessarily be found in each of us.
Ginger, we'll pick that up, and I'm sure that's my rough interpretation of the collective unconscious notion, but do you raise this because you said you work in adult outpatient services? Are you working with people dealing with psychosis, and you're worried?
Well, that's exactly what I'm worried about. I wouldn't want any average person who might not have the time or perspective to look at this closely to be left with the impression that, what Mr. Jung experienced as part of his unconscious would be necessarily something that any one of us would come anywhere near experiencing.
Let us pick it up. It's a good point, Ginger, and thank you. David Oswald, you're the Jungian analyst. On the one hand, we're trying to sort of wrestle here with the layman's understanding of collective unconscious. At the same time, you hear Ginger's concern. If you think this is yours, it could be unsettling.
She is absolutely right. My sense of, after looking at this book, if anything, this book should be nailed to the doors of all of our training institutes and say, look, the unconscious is not a toy. It's a very dangerous thing. And the critical point is always the strength of the ego, the strength of the I, when it goes into the unconscious world and confronts these things that are in the unconscious and is able to deal with them. And that is the most important thing. And Jung was very strong about that. And throughout this text, that is what is very impressive. It makes it difficult to read, but it is always this conscious I confronting these things and then not giving in to them, not identifying with them, but engaging them and saying, yes, teach me how I'm supposed to deal with the unconscious, but then stepping back and say, okay, that's what you say, the unconscious, and yet now what do I think? And it is that kind of process, that kind of interaction, that is the essence and the most important thing in dealing with the unconscious.
The unconscious is a dangerous thing, but also the door, if I understand correctly, the doorway to the soul.
It is both. It is the fact that the doorway to the soul is a dangerous
place to be. Well, that figures. I mean, talking peanuts here.
Yes, yes, it is. And I mean, one will see that in here. It is dangerous in the perspective that there are very potentially aggressive and chaotic contents that can be released. And if a person's not ready to deal with those in some way, it can be very disturbing and overwhelming and lead to chaos and psychosis and all sorts of difficulties in people.
Sarah, I wonder what you're thinking as you hear Ginger's caution and David's response.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, I think that two points I'd like to make, mm-hmm. Just so listeners also have a sense of the context of this book. You know, we're describing it and reading the fantastical elements, but there really is a thread of self-analysis that's going through it. As David mentions, you know, his distance from what's happening to him is apparent. He's participating, but he's also very critical of himself throughout. And so that sense of the ego being strong is there. And then the other thing is, during the 6-year period where he had his confrontation with the unconscious, you know, it wasn't a complete breakdown for him. I mean, the image that always stays with me is he had a very full private practice. For a time, he was on Swiss military duty, and he would go find a quiet place where he'd sit in his office at night and have these visions. So when I first
saw
pretty
wild, have dinner and then put your slippers on and go and have these wild,
exactly.
Wild dialectic with the unconscious.
Exactly, and you see the book, and you can certainly understand why it might be perceived as a war of a lunatic, because it's feverish and it's intense. But upon a close reading, and I really recommend that, there's a scholar named Sanu Shamdasani who did really about a decade worth of focused work on this, and he puts it into really wonderful historical context and in the context of Jung's life, and delineates what that line is between madness and developing a method for exploring one's active imaginations.
We talked with John Peck, who was one of the translators of the Red Book, and he was talking about how Carl Jung took, he said, an extreme personal risk here at the same time, David. Said he established a relationship with the transpersonal psyche that was coming at him. It was like learning to swim after being thrown in the pool. He was having troubling dreams, was concerned he was schizophrenic. If I've got that right.
You got that right. And that's one of the things that's very moving about this book, is that when you read the text, you see him approach that point, that you see him approach that point of being overwhelmed by these contents and struggling, and one of his imaginations is even putting himself into an insane asylum and saying, listen, I can't distinguish reality anymore. And yet at the same time, this eye steps back afterwards and says, what is going on here? And we know there are very dramatic pictures in this book. He talks at one point about the birth of God in his soul, which is in very dramatic imagery there.
Almost Christian imagery.
Almost Christian imagery.
A winged crucifix.
Catholic monks often pray out of an identification with the Virgin Mary, that they say, let me be like Mary so that Jesus is born in my soul. And we see pictures of very, very different images of that going on in Jung's process. And a naive person will look at that and say, oh, this is Jung's enlightenment. This is the God coming and so forth. And yet at the end of this book, he says, in effect, I was not able to resolve things. The birth of this God in his soul did not solve his problem. It brought him to the edge of madness, if you will. And he says in this epilogue, he says, I was... A superficial observer will look at this book and consider it madness. And it would have been madness if I was not able to channel this energy into other things. That it was actually a different field. He says alchemy gave me a better tool to work with this material. And
alchemy, turning lead into gold? Or a different reference here?
Well, you know, it was that subject. That's a sort of a big digression to get into.
But you raised the word, and I just... It is about the sort of trends.
Jung saw alchemy as people working on spiritual problems that were projected out into matter. He saw alchemists mm-hmm. working on matter, kind of saying, can we withdraw this psychic element, the gold? The alchemists would mm-hmm. always say, our gold is not the common gold. And it was a symbol for a kind of a spiritual or an inner quality that they were trying to reach. And that was really what Jung was trying to do. When people talk about reaching their soul, the soul can be a very... There's all sorts of things within the soul. And Jung's whole work and the whole work of alchemy is about finding the proper attitude towards these things coming from the unconscious. The alchemists write again and again about how the nature of the process is important. You get the fire too hot and the vessel breaks, and you get it too cold and the fire goes out. And in terms of relating to one's inner world, it is a long and difficult process to find the right attitude towards these things.
We have so many callers and so little time. Mike in Halifax, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi, Tom. I was just curious. It sounds as if all of Jung's experiences were through a natural process, but I was just curious if he ever did experiment with mind-altering drugs like ayahuasca or DMT or peyote or something like that. Just because his interactions with his unconscious sound similar to images that I've heard described by people like shamans and other type of people like that have experience with those. So I'm just curious.
Let us pick it up, Mike. I mean, a lot of these look almost like images we associate with Aldous Huxley in the world of psychedelic drugs. Did Jung use mind-altering drugs, David Oswald?
Not that I'm aware of. I suppose it's possible, but I'm not really aware of it. But the fact that there is similarity in those images is an indication of the fact that we have this potential in us. And today there are many, many techniques that one can rip open the unconscious and release all kinds of fascinating fantasies and energies. And it is not the intent at all of Jungian analysis to do that. If people want to do that, they can go do their own drug
experiment. Is it an accident that these images look something like what we associate with the psychedelic drug?
Not at all, I don't think. I think it is the fact that drugs can break down consciousness in exactly mm-hmm. the same way, and these contents can come out. It's sort of a shortcut, if you will, to the hard work of developing your ego to confront those things without it.
Jesse in Springfield, Massachusetts. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi. Fascinating topic. I was very influenced by Jung's autobiography and had to drop out of college and find real teachers. And I have depicted images from dreams, not only for my own benefit, but I've been doing dreams and music with fierce dedication since I was first in a psych hospital 21 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I just recently showed some of the psych hospital art to the public for the first time. So some of the stuff that I've depicted from dreams, like or the image realm that busts into my life, are things like a skull weeping blood and a red skull with a dagger through its eye. And I'm wary of showing those images to the public, but when I have, there are people who are fascinated, like them, want them, and I've distributed, I've done a ton of pictures, and there's probably 200 or 300 of them that I've given away or sold, including a whole bunch of brain images that I did.
But you understand Jung's trepidation about doing it, even in your own case, Jesse, because people may look and say... Jesse, thank you. David Oswald, you hear this this listener's concern. You, images come to you, you share them, you don't know how people are going to react.
That's true. That's I think that's partly why Jung was so hesitant to publish this book, partly due to his reputation, partly due to his concern for the family. It is a concern that these images take on a life of their own, and at some point... one has to either say no, I'm not going to hide it at all. And that was, in fact, you know, in the Faust books, where they say, if you know something about the devil, if you know something about the other side, keep silent, don't talk about it. And so it is a kind of trust of trusting that the other people that are receiving it will be able to receive it in some way. I mean, that's one reason why in therapy, where you have as an analyst, as a therapist, is you have responsibility for what you're doing to the other people, and it's you don't give them images that they aren't able to deal with.
Sarah, these are remarkable images, remarkable passages. The history is remarkable too. Of course, he lived through World War II after his images that related to World War I. Even advised the Allies in understanding the psyche of the Nazi high command during that World War II wartime, but never brought this forward. And now we all stare at it. I wonder if Carl Jung could watch and listen to the world respond to his images. Who knows, Sarah? But you do know of his hesitance to put it out there.
Right. You know, it's funny because a number of his grandchildren said the exact same thing to me, which was, if he were here today, he would find this all hilarious. He had a sense of humor about himself and about the world. And, you know, I think he had, as we've said, a strong ego. So I think he would find this all wonderful and charming, and he never shied away from controversy. And this is, you know, this is a great moment for him posthumously.
But you quote Shamdasani, who you mentioned earlier, saying the basic message he's sending is value your inner life. It may be hilarious in one way, seeing this most intimate thing in such a public forum now, but this was a very, very almost deadly serious exploration on his part.
Right. No, I think he would think that all the debate and all the concern about it is funny. I think that the document itself is, you know, as he said in Jung's own words, you know, this was the foundation for his life's work. It was the most important period of his life. And if you look at the book, and I encourage people to go look at some of the images available on the website, because the care he put into making that book shows how valuable it was to him. And I think Jung was a man who loved symbols, and the book itself as an object is a terrific symbol of how important he viewed his own inner life. And the message, I think, to the people beyond is exactly what Shamdasani said, that he's saying value that life. Go explore it.
Sarah Corbett, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, thank you for bringing all this to us, Sarah, in your article. And thanks for joining us today. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
And David Oswald, a Jungian analyst with the book right in his lap practically here now. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, images from Carl Jung's The Red Book at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.